Hello and welcome to the Legendarium Green Team, a fan podcast. I am your host, Stormrunner, and I am joined today by the God Kings of Karg, Kip Tan, Huron Fan, and Ashman. Today we will be discussing all of the Tombs of Atuan by Ursula K. Le Guin, book 2 of the Earthsea series, which is published, and this one being published in 1971. So we will start with a non-spoiler section, and then we'll go into give a spoiler warning before we head into spoiler territory.
Your insult was much worse than the one I wrote.
we'll go with that one. What did everyone think of the book at a general high non-spoilery level?
Personally speaking, I liked it more than The Wizard of Earthsea.
Okay.
I really enjoyed the atmosphere. I liked the main character. I enjoyed the perspective of being behind the eyes, so to speak, of a tiny little girl. I liked how dark and insular you felt. It was a lot more emotional for me, and I thought it was a perfect sequel to an incredible book.
Definitely not the first time that I read this book, but it's the one that I remember the most. So I thought that this book was, like Aaron said, a better book. Sorry, dog just bit me.
I didn't say better. I said I liked it more.
I think it's better. I think it's more focused. I think it's got a tighter pacing and doesn't wander nearly as much as A Wizard of Earthsea did. And so I think that The Tombs of Atuan is a worthy successor, even though it completely switches characters and we get a brand new introduction to Tinar or Arha, which I'm going to pretend I haven't read any of the books and say that I hope we get more of her.
I'm going to break with you guys and say that I didn't like it as much as The Wizard of Earthsea. I still really loved this, though. It is my second time through. But yeah, the core theme of, you know, growing up and realizing that what you were brought up in is not healthy and not good, and, you know, learning to find your own way in the world, I really resonated with it. I thought it was excellent, and I mean, like, it's so hard to read anything from Le Guin and think, oh, like anything other than, oh, this is excellent. She's an amazing writer. Like she's one of the all time greats of sci-fi and fantasy. Sci-fi and fantasy. So like every book I'm gonna come after and be like, yeah, well, excellent. I love how she deals with things. Her prose is excellent. The emotional beats always hit, and she does so much more with so much less than a lot of authors. You know, a lot of authors really hit you with a lot of things plot wise, and there's not like a whole lot here plot wise, and it is pretty concise. And she just does everything so effectively with it. It's
nothing is frivolous. Nothing.
No,
nothing is there that doesn't serve multiple purposes.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just want to attack you again for no reason.
I am. More with Ash and that I still really enjoyed it, but not quite as much as the first one. I hear what you're saying, Kip, with it was more focused in that sense. I did feel like, maybe it's just because of the nature of the book, I felt like we were, I don't want to say dragged, because like it's not, there isn't enough space in the book for it to really drag, but it felt constricted, and that's obviously very intentional, and we'll, I'm sure, get into that. But it's Le Guin, like Ashley, you were saying, it's she, even if it's something I don't love that she might be doing, I at least recognize, okay, this is still masterful, and what she's doing is just good writing. Mm-hmm. And I did really feel for Tanar / Arha at a lot of moments. And I thought that her, in general, her journey was done really well in a way that that was still very obviously coming of age, but very different than Ged's in book one, in a way that felt true to the type of story Le Guin wanted to tell with this book. And again, very different book from book one, in a way that I think was ultimately refreshing, but definitely different.
I want to hear why you think this is more focused than the first one. Certainly in a setting, it's more focused, but what more specifically do you mean?
Well, I think that setting focus can carry quite a bit of weight, but I think that the tight focus on the tombs themselves for like at least, I don't know, 80-90% of the novel, it's a lot less peripatetic than Ged's wandering all across Earthsea to try and find the answers to his problems. The Ged, the wandering mage, is too wandering.
I thought it was more focused, but I did like Ged's more sprawling. I don't know. I really liked the wandering travel parts of Earthsea, and I think it's because of how Le Guin wrote them.
Listeners and fellow podcasters, you can't see the smile on my face, but yes, I am beaming from ear to ear when calling Ged too peripatetic.
So I would agree that this is a more focused story. I also think that the more wandering nature of Orisa Earthsea is also kind of the point. Yeah, it's a style thing. Like, different things are going to work for different people, I think. And I would not dispute anybody saying that they rank one above the other, so long as they acknowledge that both are objectively excellent.
I can do that.
Very, very, very different books.
Yes.
Incredible. Yes, very different books.
That's what's great about them. I really wish more series would do that. The amount of series that like can change the style and change the perspective and the theme focus and the character focus from book to book, you could probably count on like your hands, right? And Le Guin did it in the 70s, so why don't we do it more now? Because it's great.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that some people would point to Gideon the Ninth and Harrow the Ninth and be like, look, it's happening today.
That's a whole that's a whole conversation, but yeah. I think part of that is because series now, it's you're right, authors want to write a series, and so that's going to be a sequence of events that is leading up to something. Whereas at least with books one and two, Le Guin didn't set out to write this big series. It was she had a sequence of ideas that she wrote in book into novels that connect but are not. And create or are creating, as I haven't read the other books, but are creating a larger whole. But it's not about, oh, I need to just finish Earths. I need to get through Earthsea to get to this big payoff, because that's not the point.
That's a good point. It's a lot more episodic in nature compared to like maybe television series that's, you know, has a finale in mind compared to something that's like Star Trek.
I blame the franchisation of everything and the branding, and you know, everything needs to be based off of something else. Everything needs to, you know, for every story we have to have, oh, you remember this fun thing from your childhood, let's bring it back. Or I think publishers are much less willing to take on people like Le Guin who just want to tell short self-contained stories. But you know, Piranesi exists. Piranesi? I don't know how that's pronounced.
Well, so, that exists because she wrote Jonathan Street, one of the like big fantasy novels of the 2000s.
Yes.
But those are standalones. They're not in a series.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
That is true.
Still true.
We're talking about series that switch things up.
Yeah.
I don't know, like Malazan does it, but to varying degrees of popularity.
Maybe? Craft sequence? Maybe? Is that enough?
I would agree.
The culture, I haven't read a ton of them, but
culture. Yeah.
Culture, I mean, was inversion.
Yeah. That's true, yeah. That was what yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we're including culture, we have to also include like Redwall, I think. right?
I read that one. Yeah, so those are some good series for our listeners who want to read something that changes things up every book.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyways, now that we're definitely not talking about
the Uplift series too. Then.
Right. The which series?
The Uplift Saga.
Oh yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Until the final trilogy, right?
Yeah.
Well, the final trilogy is quite a departure from Bryn's habit of only ever doing standalones.
Yeah, but I'm saying that the final trilogy is more of a traditional trilogy.
Yes, but there's three books before that.
Oh, so. Kay does it.
To the point where you don't even know stuff exists in the same world.
But they're in the same world.
They are.
You know, you'll occasionally stumble upon references. And Hyperion does it.
Well, Hyperion just like Hyperion doesn't. The Hyperion, that's a four book series that's more sequential.
So
it's two book series. Really.
Well, okay, yeah.
Let's talk about Earthsea.
Yeah, yes, yeah. All right, yeah. Any other higher level thoughts, or before we go into spoilers?
I got some low level stuff. If that's okay.
Yeah, we're here for the low-level stuff.
I will say that this time around, I had an entirely different set of allegories thinking about this series, and this time it was corporate work culture.
Really? That's interesting.
I can see it, yeah.
I can see it now that I'm thinking about it, and I can see that. There's layers there.
I mean, this time I was just thinking, wow, there's a real feminist bent to this story.
Actually, more than the first one.
Yes, absolutely, and it was like definitely consciously done.
Yeah.
But, I think she even says in one of her intros that she wanted to do, like, it wasn't like as feminist as she wanted to make it, and that's why she did certain things with books later on or something.
Yeah, it's 1971. She's probably also kind of exploring that in her own life and deciding where she is, and just like everybody.
I think it does a great job of showing a really toxic feminine culture, because arguably the story itself considers there to be no men in the story until some way in.
Oh, okay. Yes. No penis. Gotcha.
Yeah.
No something, anyways.
Yeah. We don't know.
We don't know what kind of eunuch they are, right?
Well, okay. Considering their physicality, I think they definitely have the dongles removed.
I don't know.
That was my impression.
There's magic
but we also
all of my assumptions are out the window.
Yeah, and she did write another book like about with the whole idea of gender not being or having very different application. But so maybe I could see it. But
so if you remember in the first episode of Earthsea, I said Earthsea had one character. Its name was Ged, and everybody else is just there for Ged. I think this book does that better. In that the other characters felt more like real living people instead of just functions in the story for Tanar to find growth or live in contrast of her, if that makes sense. Because we already know Sparrowhawk, and the people in Tanar's life who are there, I felt were a lot more real, if that makes sense.
Do we want to go into spoilers now, or...
We're still out.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, I mean, there's more characters that stick around for more than one chapter at a time,
which is helpful.
Who was your like favorite secondary character?
Who was the main priest?
Because I think mine was Thar this time.
Choose Ged, I choose Thar. So
is Thar her bodyguard?
No, Thar was the like spindly priestess.
Okay.
She was the one who taught her the secrets of the first priestess.
I like the mean priestess, the one of the god kings who
Kossel,
thank you. She's my favorite.
Interesting.
I probably Penth, her friend from like in more just because of the dynamic they have early on, I thought was very poignant.
Ooh, yeah.
I agree.
I think Rothfuss names a character after Penth. In,
well, Penthi is an old name. It's from an ancient Greek name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, like, Rothfuss read too much on before he wrote the Kingkiller Chronicles.
What, do you mean he didn't invent naming as a magic system?
No, but neither did Le Guin.
True.
I'm actually reading another naming system magic book right now, Lyriel, of the Old Kingdom trilogy, and it was interesting watching the similarities between the two, specifically around the titles that the characters want or don't want or are striving for, have earned, haven't earned, and how it affects them having these titles or not.
There's some other similarities now that I think about it, but that's an interesting point.
I really wish that modern culture had more placed more importance on names. I mean, I guess to your point about corporate culture, Kip, that exists there. But
oh, yeah. Your second assistant, the CTO.
Yeah. I blame birth certificates. We should abolish birth certificates so people can have evolving names. You know.
Yeah, and national identities
like culture names.
Like names that you can earn, and like your name can like morph over time, and then like when you present yourself at a gathering, you can have someone read out your list of names and what they all mean.
Okay, you know, it sounds great when you say it like that. It's a nightmare reading about that kind of stuff, though. It makes everything so much more confusing.
Half of
do you know how many times Tokugawa Ieyasu changed his name, or like Toyotomi Hideyoshi?
Okay, Japanese culture probably takes it to an extreme.
But, I'm so glad they don't do it anymore.
You know, there's a happy medium that you could find.
The happy medium is everyone has the same name.
Ah, and the name is Harrison Bergeron.
No, it's probably like Matthew.
I mean, statistically, it would be Muhammad, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Everyone just named Muhammad one.
Muhammad Lee.
After that, you know, two, three, four.
Muhammad with a number, really?
No.
Maybe a CUID after first name.
Yeah.
CUID?
Yeah.
You have a lot more digit efficiency there then. Should we move on to spoilers?
Yeah, anyways, yeah.
Yeah,
so. Back to...
Yeah, before we get into QR code people.
That would be so nice.
Well, people can just like in like computers, just like
scan your
just learn to like emit sounds with specific vibration patterns.
Frequencies.
Yeah.
Well, now we're back to Uplift and David Byrne.
Yeah.
With sonar.
Just chirp at each other.
Yeah.
Anyone know a book about creatures made of sound waves? Because that could be a thing.
I'm pretty sure Ken Liu wrote some of that for his paper menagerie.
That sounds too much like the Linguist Mages.
It does, doesn't it? I'm sorry.
All right. So now that we've gone on tangents about things tangents about not Earthsea than Earthsea. Anything else before we go into spoilers?
Great book. Read it if you haven't.
Yeah.
It's so short.
Read it.
Take time.
Read it and then immediately read The Farthest Shore, because that one is really the best of the series.
And if you didn't like the first book, definitely read this one because it's so different.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And if you have daughters, make them read this. And sons. You know, just you have children.
And dogs.
Well, I don't think they'd be able to grasp the nuances.
You can read it to
them. You could. All right. So spoiler warning for Tombs of Atuan. And 3, 2, 1. All right. So we'll do a summary of sorts. So Tombs of Atuan follows Tainar, who is a girl born in the Kargish Empire, who was taken when she was a child to become the high priestess to the Nameless Ones at the Tombs of Atuan. And she was born on the same day as the previous high priestess, and so that's why they I guess that association. So her, she had a pretty lonely existence, and her world basically was just the tombs and the compound or area that the priestesses live on. And she was pretty constricted until Ged arrives, and she's still then constricted. But after trapping Ged and having a back and forth with him of sorts, and having him help her realize that she was a prisoner of her, basically a prisoner of her own, of the priest, of the priestesses, and of the religion of Karg. Her and Ged escape from the tombs, and continue on their adventures from there, and that's where the book ends. I'm missing a lot, but that's especially about the priestesses Thar and Kassil, but we can get into some of that in a little bit.
I thought it was a cool choice to put this in the Kargish lands, considering what we learned from the first book about the Karg-ish were that they just raided, and they're responsible for the raid in Sparrowhawk's town. I think it's a really interesting culture, and it kind of felt like Vikings mixed with Indians.
Interesting.
Well, Vikings because they're kind of like they're raiders, right? And Indians because they have this interesting religion that's puts a lot of emphasis on reincarnation. Although the reincarnation ritual kind of more resembles the Dalai Lama or Aang in Avatar, if you're more familiar with that. But then the God King is kind of its own thing.
Yeah, that's
kind of resembling a lot of ancient religions. I thought it was a really cool culture. And the setting, well, let's just go on the Karg. Anyone have any thoughts on the Kargish?
Honestly, I didn't think they were very well developed. So I didn't really bother trying to learn much about them.
Yeah, I wish we had seen more in general from them. Like, what we got was interesting, but I wish we had seen, like, more interactions, like, maybe other people, like, other people from the, like, if not the God King himself, then one of his
Not a story about them.
Or then some sort of interaction with, like, the Kargish Empire.
I think you learn a lot about the Kargish just from Tanar's perspective. She knows very, very little about any of it, and everything is filtered through you know, what she learns and what she could remember from her eunuch friend and from the other priestesses, and how that power kind of seeps down in, even into seeping into her responsibilities and her religion and the tension that's present there.
Yeah, we're seeing like echoes at quite a remove. We see that there's this ascension of the cult of the God King, and we see that they have quite a bit of money to spend on Kossel's house and her palace and her offerings and worship. But we don't really see much else. We see nothing of like Kargish politicians or ambassadors or diplomats or even common townsfolk. We don't see any map of their territory. We just
see what
one temple on the farthest reaches of their empire has to say about them. And to me, that's what we care about the temple, not necessarily this distant political empire that lays claim to them.
Yeah, this distant, like, powerful empire that does lay claim to him, it obviously has a lot of influence anyway. Even though they are so far away.
Well, but it would have been
course,
good
to... Of course, but we don't get to know much about it.
Yeah, and it's filtered through her perspective, which is also kind of why I like this book so much.
It's like, it's an archetype more than a concrete instance.
I think how the book uses her perspective was very effective, but I agree that it would have been at least seeing the Empire do something... So that even like one instance, just so we can see, oh, like this is what might happen if they go like against the Empire, or this is the impact that the priestesses have on the Empire or something like that.
I appreciate getting primarily the perspective of, okay, she's obviously not a nobody, Tanar, and these priestesses, they're like, they are important to the function of the Empire. But no one ever goes there, right? Like, they never have any visitors, essentially. And they're kind of just, like, left to their own devices. So they know they're part of an empire. They, you know, they have some kind of sense of identification with the God King. But for most peoples who lived in empires, they'd never really interacted with the machinations that were going on. So I appreciate the perspective, and it's not one that you really get in fantasy a lot, but it is the perspective that most people had.
And I like it.
It's nice, yeah.
The perspective's a good choice. That's, yeah. I just would have liked to have seen, like, an instance of something material, the Empire doing something material, or some sort of material interaction with the Empire. But it doesn't.
I like that we never really see them caring.
I agree.
I like that we see that the Empire exists, that they have nominal control over this area, and that they just send the requisite tributes and payment and upkeep and leave it alone.
That was part of why I like Penth so much. She seemed so practical when it came to the God King. She's like, I like religion, whatever. I understand other people care about it. Me, I'm just here because, you know, I had no other choice. I know you care about these nameless ones, whatever. That's your thing. And I'm sure the God King is a God King. I mean, he's a god, but I mean, the dude's bald. I think he'll probably
be... clicks his toenails just the same as the rest of us.
Like, I think he'll be a lot more godlier after he's dead.
Yeah. That's like the one time in the book, I think, where Penth shows like a flash of wisdom.
But like, you could tell just from the conversation that really affected Tanar. And
yes. Oh, yeah. Their relationship is one of my favorite parts of the book, in terms of just how it develops.
Earlier, when I forgot what I said, but it was contrasting Earthsea and this one. And in Earthsea, I feel like the perspective is a lot more open, even though it's really only from Geds. I feel like the camera, so to speak, or the narrator is a lot more pulled back, and we get to see a lot more of things outside of Ged, if that makes sense. Whereas in this one, for the most part, unless she's talking with other people, it's really just an isolated perspective for Tanar. And I think that was such a really good choice. And it's also why it gives such a claustrophobic and dark feeling. And I really like books that have a very focused perspective. And everything that they hear and everything they think and everything they say is filtered through that perspective. And the only information they get are from certain sources. And so you only know what they know. And she did fantastic.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, that all was very good.
And I was constantly thinking, I think because Tanar was thinking the same things, is like, is this religion real? Are the Nameless Ones real? Am I actually reincarnated? Is the God King real? And like, all these doubts are coming in slowly, slowly. And I still don't quite really know, personally, a lot of what was real and what was not, you know?
I really appreciate how the Nameless Ones, even though so much of what she was fed was lies, the power of the Nameless Ones is still very much real.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of just like surrounding her whole life and influencing how she thought and how she grew up, essentially. And the resistance, once she had changed her mind, she wanted to get out, the resistance that she felt all of a sudden to actually leaving, I think that was really well done.
Yeah, no, that was, because we don't find out that they're any sort of real until the end, and when they collapse the tombs, mm-hmm. then it's like, oh yeah, they're real. they can definitely affect things, like your physical things.
But back to perspective and the way each book is written, I think it's related to the gender dynamics. In the first Earthsea book, it was more of a traditional fantasy male coming of age story, and he's given a lot more freedom, and through that freedom he has more access to the world and better understanding. Whereas with this book, I feel like Ursula is saying something about how girls are treated and how and I'll stop there because I don't know what the f*** I'm talking about.
I did have, and this isn't specifically about how girls are treated, because I'm also not gonna like speak on that particular part, but
Let's have four guys talk about how girls are treated when they grow up.
Right. But
I just feel like that they're given fewer opportunities to, I don't know, learn, if that makes sense.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, yes, is all I'll say without, because I'm not going
to. You know what? I'll bravely venture into this.
I'll say that notably, Tanar can't read.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's because the Kargish don't really believe in, yeah.
Yes, that is a Kurgish thing.
So, from my perspective, yes, I definitely think Luquin is saying something about how girls are raised, but especially how girls are raised in certain, shall we say, more conservative cultures. Coming from my background, the distinction was it was kind of similar to the distinction get in Tanar, where I had this growing up experience that was a lot more open, and you know, there were all these things that the girls in my community were being told that I never heard about, and so Lady Ash came from the same background that I did. She was told growing up that, you know, she can't ever talk to boys. She's not allowed to look at them. She's not allowed to, you know, have any kinds of relationship with them. I was never told this, sort of. It was just kind of generally discouraged to talk to girls. But, you know, you weren't like, the hammer didn't really come down if you did. But I think that it is kind of very telling that the moment when Tanar really begins to change is when she finally gets to see a member of the opposite sex come into her life and, you know, get to talk with them like on honest terms. Even though it's not a sexual dynamic between them, there is still a realization of various dynamics that hadn't been present before.
Do you think that there's a metaphor in his ring, his half of the ring and her half of the ring?
No.
I don't,
okay.
Yeah, no. I think their ring exchanging has absolutely nothing to do with any sort of allegory.
No. Uh-huh. Thanks for wading into that scary, murky waters.
I'm not.
Listeners, get as angry at me as you want. I can take the heat.
Yeah, I think that sex separation during early education is a form of indoctrination. I'll mm-hmm. enter in these murky waters. And I think that all of the rumors about the opposite sex don't long survive contact with them.
Well, some of them do.
I'm going to disagree with you there.
I think indoctrination is an operative word for this book in particular. But yeah.
A lot of this book feels like an attack of traditionalism.
Yeah.
Yes.
Traditionalism? Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, hey, maybe just because there's this old, powerful thing that's been living forever doesn't mean that maybe we should worship it.
Yeah, and the while it may look on the surface like nothing sinister is going on, there are all kinds of forces that might be working to sinister ends, let's say.
Or like unexpected.
And maybe the thing that makes you think that there's no way out and you can't possibly escape and that you might as well just give up and die is maybe not coming from inside you.
A lot of that being cultural expectations and both maybe explicit social structures for a given society and some of the not as the more implied or norm-based expectations of a given society.
Who hasn't felt caught in a labyrinth at one time or another?
Yeah.
There is a quote I actually had for that that is essentially from this. It's after Tanar escapes. kind of long. She did feel it. A dark hand had let go its lifelong hold upon her heart, but she did not feel joy as she had in the mountains. She put her head down in her arms and cried, and her cheeks were salt and wet. She cried for the waste of her years in bondage to a useless evil. She wept in pain because she was free. What she had begun to learn was the weight of liberty. Freedom is a heavy load, a great and strange burden for the spirit to undertake. It is not easy. It is not a gift given, but a choice made, and the choice may be a hard one. The road goes upward towards the light, but the laden traveler may never reach the end of it.
That's nice.
That one...
You took my quote.
Excellent. Yeah, that that really resonated with me. Growing up in a very insular, very traditional, very conservative culture where, among other things, we were told that everybody that wasn't part of our culture was evil. And let's just say that the pool was much bigger on the outside than on the inside. And when you leave, it's kind of like, okay, what do I do now? What do I do with all of this knowledge? How can I really reconcile myself to the years of my life that I now feel are wasted? Now, I don't feel like I was serving any evil powers, but at the same time, like, I kind of feel like my childhood was stolen away, like Tanar does here, you know? And that's kind of like a hard thing to reconcile with. And this is something that I've had a lot of conversations with people about. And it's a hard thing.
At least no one made you kill people during your childhood.
Absolutely. I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah,
and you have all this, like,
didn't kill anybody. They starved.
They starved.
And you have all this kind of like useless knowledge just knocking around in your head. And Tanar, her knowledge of the labyrinth is entirely useless outside the world. She doesn't know how to live, basically. She learned a few useful skills, like, you know, like knitting, I think, and processing wool. But for the most part, like, everything that she learned, completely useless to her now. What's she going to do with it? She has to start from rock bottom, as she said. And that's...
I don't know. She learned some knife tricks.
Yeah, in service of a ritual dance that she probably doesn't want to do again.
You know what? Those calisthenics will come in handy somewhere, I'm sure.
Yeah, maybe.
Or the confidence of, if I could get out of that situation from a kind of self-actualization perspective, if I can get out of this situation, then I can figure out how to get through other similarly constrictive situations later on.
And there are some benefits, for sure.
Like, I'm not trying to say there's a benefit, but yes.
It teaches you something about the world and about belief systems, and gives you an idea of what kind of traps people can fall into, and hopefully gives you an idea on how to avoid them. But obviously, there are a lot of people who, you know, kind of fall into cults after they leave a cult. So it's not by any means a foolproof thing.
She learned how to be imperious.
Yeah.
It's true.
And no one called her bossy growing up. So, you know, a feminist culture.
No, even Kossel probably wouldn't say that.
Yeah.
Why would Kossel call someone bossy? Her experience in a toxic workplace environment really might land her in good stead in the future.
Yeah, I do think that I hadn't thought of that exact metaphor, but
corporate culture was going alongside me this whole read through.
I almost want to reread it now with that.
I think it actually works better when thinking about Kossel, because
like middle manager type of deal.
Kossel is exactly a middle manager, but site manager. She's site manager, but only middle management as far as like the larger corporation is concerned.
Yeah,
I love Kossel. He's the best.
The site manager of a little outpost can really go wild.
Somebody who has a little bit of power and a lot of cynicism and knows exactly what that power can do for them. I like characters like that.
Oh man, that feels like a hotter take than me kind of liking Olar Ethel and Malazan.
Well, you like Olar Ethel. Like, you just like her.
Nah, not really.
Kossel, I think, is a cool character.
Yes. Well, that... Yeah.
I thought Manon was cooler this time as well. Because there's so many little hinted moments where he could be thinking something like incredibly disturbing about Tanar, but you never get full confirmation, and he always backs down until the end where he falls into a pit. But until that point, it's like, oh, he was thinking about sexually assaulting Tanar, but didn't. And that just gets repeated.
He's a difficult character to really get a grip on, I think.
Well, I think that goes direct to what Hiram was saying. I think it was Hiram was saying earlier about the camera, so to speak, being more zoomed in with this book than with Earthsea, with Earth Wizard of Earthsea that we can't, we don't know like what's going on in the heads of a lot of these characters, where we might have gotten a glimpse of that in book one, perhaps, which is an interesting technique.
Yep.
And yet he's probably the one that's kind of most responsible besides like Ged for her being able to get out of the situation in the first place. I think like he's the one to show her kindness after her initiation. You know, he calls her Tanar even after she's been renamed Ara.
That whole thing was just heartbreaking and dehumanizing. And
yes,
the quote that I wrote down from that general section is, I forget who she's saying it to, but they can't touch me. I am Arha. And then she bursts into tears. Like, because I think that really hit home in a, like, yeah, well, you're right, they can't do anything to her, but she is also completely isolated and, like, has no, like, no actual human relationships.
And how much human contact, like physical contact, does she even have?
I don't think
so much. Little.
Yeah, if at all, much at all.
Which is why her eunuch offered.
Yeah. There was that really unethical experiment with chimps. You know, if you deprive them of touch, they just go insane. Oh God, insane.
Skinner.
Yeah.
Skinner.
Not on the last episode.
Yeah, you could say that her identity was eaten by the Nameless Ones.
Mm-hmm. Well, she kept getting told that, you know, that she literally doesn't have a soul. But at the end, Ged's like, I don't know.
If you don't have a soul, then how does reincarnation work?
That's a good question.
They return it just for the reincarnation, and they let you have it for 5 or 6 years, and then they take it back again.
They hold it until she dies, and they release it in the world.
Yeah.
For the next one. Right. Okay.
I mean, the Nameless Ones were real. I'm still up in the air about whether or not she was a real reincarnation. Who knows? Maybe we'll never know.
Yeah, I kind of doubt, I don't know, I had doubts about that just because it didn't... Well, I guess they did have that whole prologue, but I the whole thing just seemed very, like, routine in that, yeah, they just do this. Obviously, they do it every time the high priestess dies, but I don't know, it seemed... Maybe I'm just looking at it through the lens that we're looking at it through.
Of like, I would say that it's another evil, but that they do.
Yeah, like, yeah.
They convince some young girl that she is the Eden One.
I kind of like it as if she is the reincarnated soul of, you know, the first priestess. Because then it shows, like, the breaking of the cycle, you know? Like, this is kind of the end of something that has been holding on to this culture for... However, I mean, like thousands of years, and now it's done.
Either way, it's still the breaking of a cycle.
Yes,
you say this culture, but it's a people who actually pay homage to these Nameless Ones are, it's a small group, and their power is diminishing. I'd say more for the individuals that they did this to, it would be more powerful.
But at the same time, like there was still like this festering wound at the heart of this empire, and now it seems like it's finally consumed itself, you know? And yeah, I think it's very poignant if the first priestess, like the actual first priestess is the one that kind of brought that about. You know, like you can change your mind about your belief system at any time. It's never too late to kind of wake up, you know?
It's never too late.
Wake up.
You can be an 80,000 year soul and you still change your mind.
This reminds me, I don't know why, actually I kind of know why. This book and like these themes and kind of the atmosphere reminds me of the game Eco.
I don't think I've ever played that.
I know.
Isn't that?
Yeah. Oh, the
Shadow of Colossus, yeah.
It was Fumito Ueda's first game, and there's also a book. I read the book. I really enjoyed it. But the game is incredible, and I recommend it for everybody. And it's a mood.
I only know the game Eco with an E.
Oh, Echo? The dolphin?
No, Echo's another one, but I know Eco as well.
Showed the prologue. That's like the one time we get a perspective that's not what's it, Tanar? And it's like it's perfectly sad, and it was like 2 pages long.
I want to read the first few sentences of the book.
Sorry, go ahead.
Okay. Come home, Tanar, come home. In the deep valley in the twilight, the apple trees were on the eve of blossoming. Here and there among the shadowed boughs, one flower had opened early, rose and white like a faint star, down the orchard aisles. In the thick, new wet grass, the little girl ran for the joy of running. Hearing the call, she did not come at once, but made a long circle before she turned her face towards home. The mother, waiting at the doorway of the hut, with the firelight behind her, watched the tiny figure running and bobbling like a bit of thistledown blown over the darkening grass beneath the trees. Beautiful.
And then later, when she says, I'll let her go when it's time, you know, she refuses to not bond with her child, even though she knows she's never going to see her again, like, a year.
Yeah. I was really drawn to the words around being reborn and the themes of that, and about her needing specifically to leave the place where she had all of these associations and memories and ties. And her cutting that with the expanse of ocean in between the islands. And it really just brings me back to this idea of Earthsea being a lot of places surrounded by water.
Mm.
And the ability of a single individual to completely change their life just by getting on a tiny little boat and going somewhere new. And I was wondering, have you guys ever felt like you were reborn somewhere just by traveling somewhere new? Is there any time in your life where you let go of something that was holding you back, went off, and majorly changed your life?
No. I moved to an entirely different country with a very different culture for no reason. Nothing's changed.
I think every time I've gone to a new culture, I feel like things have changed, like, pretty deeply in me. And I love being in nature. So every time that I get to be by the ocean I feel a call of the ocean. And at one point I also did the Grand Canyon. And yeah, again, like it's just like an impossibly profound experience. So yeah, I'm a huge fan of travel changing your life.
Yes, similar to that, for me it's like just being in the mountains, particularly like Utah and Colorado and in the United States, and some of the like hikes I've went on, like when you reach like the top of the mountain and like that type of view and catharsis can be life changing in a sense. Going to experiencing different cultures and how that like very different from your own, and reflecting on or seeing how that reflects on you and like the culture you're from.
Okay.
What about you, Kip?
Oh, geez. I think probably the best and most notable one for me is when I went off to boarding school for the first time. That was huge.
Well, I bet.
Big change.
No one comes back from boarding school unchanged, it seems.
No, that's kind of the point. It is why they can charge the big bucks.
I really appreciated the end. Like, the book does not end with her just leaving. The book ends with her figuring out what she's going to do next. And if you're coming out of a culture that keeps you busy all the time and keeps you with the same people all the time, going out into the new world is terrifying, and you don't know what to do or what your life purpose is going to be now. And I thought the way to end the book was perfect, because I think for a general population, like, that's not necessarily something they would understand. I don't know. I obviously can't speak for that. But
first time in the city, yeah.
Yeah, like, so you see it with people who break from being, like, Mennonite or something. You know, like, it's a complete shift, a complete realignment of your entire world. You don't know anybody. Like, losing your entire social structure, it changes things. I really liked how the book made you know, like, the deep sadness that comes with that, even though, like, you probably still want to have left, but, like, leaving your whole world behind is hard.
Yeah, I will say that going from one New England state to another for boarding school was not as big as some of my classmates who came from, like, Ethiopia.
Oh, yeah, no kidding.
The closest that I visited some friends in India, and that was very different. Like, that was also just for like 2 weeks, and not a and I had them guiding me the whole time, but there were still parts that were very eye-opening and very reflective. And then, I mean, going off to college, that's, I didn't go super far from home, so that wasn't as much of a shift. But
I was the perfect distance from home for college, like 3-hour drive.
That's I was almost the same, like a little closer, but similar.
3 hours was also for boarding school for me. For college, I thought it could be closer to home, hour and a half.
Shall we wrap up?
All right. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Well, yeah. So then that concludes this episode discussing the Tombs of Atuan by Ursula K. Le Guin. Join us on the Legendarium Discord, the somewhat self-styled friendliest place on the internet, for more fun discussion. Again, I'm Stormrunner with Kip, Dan, Hiran, Fan, and Ashmon. And thanks to Craig and the Legendarium podcast, Horizon Brave, and to Jingle Punks for their theme music. And thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.